All right, so I'd like to thank the organizer for, no, I'm just kidding. I would like to thank all of you for coming and being part of this. It's been really fantastic. I'm really enjoying it, and I will continue to enjoy stuff a lot. So I'm going to tell you about cytoskeletal energetics and energy metabolism. And this is really, unfortunately, going to be really a part on cytoskeletal energetics and a part on energy metabolism. In the future, hopefully, those things will be integrated. But that's not what's going to be totally here. And this is really going to be, stuff from Peter, essentially, and stuff from Jingbo. And so the people who, really got stuff is here. So I'm basically, advertising their work. Okay, so I'll introduce stuff, and then I'll go to these two stories. All right, so me personally, what I'm interested in, very broadly speaking, is biological self-organization. So I want to have my scientific overriding interest is trying to have a quantitative understanding of biological processes, including how molecules self-organize into subcellular structures and cells, and how cells self-organize into tissues and organisms, and how these are perturbed in disease and change over evolutions.
So I always have a problem with the word self-organization. They don't self. What do you mean by self-organized?
Yeah. So the way I think about stuff is really influenced by the way I guess it's like Mark Kirshner and Tim Mitchison wrote about stuff. It could have been in this Molecular Vitalism article or in other articles as well, where they really kind of distinguished that you have two ways of like building biological structures. One they called self-assembly, which is the idea that you don't have energy, essentially, and nowadays we'd say like non-active matter stuff. You don't have energy input at the microscopic scale. So you mix up components of a virus and they get together you mix up proteins together and they assemble a virus by essentially just going downhill. That they called self-assembly. And then other cases where you actually are using energy to build your structure, that they called self-organization. And so that's certainly how I personally view stuff, just through that lens. All right. So nowadays, people use the term active matter to describe a lot of that stuff. So are people here, how many are familiar with that term, active matter? Or how many aren't, I guess is a better question to ask. Okay, so then I'll just super briefly, okay, so now like a lot of people in soft matter physics talk about active matter, and so I would say like this is my intro take on that, and that is that so we all know biological systems are out of equilibrium, but there are many ways that you could hypothetically be out of equilibrium. So one way you can imagine being out of equilibrium is what I just said, is that if you have components of a virus, a protein, and you mix them up, then over time they'll assemble into some final structure. And so basically your system, you've prepared it in some non-equilibrium state and it's relaxing to equilibrium without input of energy. That's one way hypothetically you could be out of equilibrium, that relaxation process, right? Another way you could be out of equilibrium is that you have some like basically equilibrium material, like a fluid, and you put in energy at the boundaries. So you have some water and you the sample chamber with water in it, you heat it from the bottom and cool it from the top, and you get this complicated flow patterns forming. And that's a non-equilibrium system. All right.
So Rob showed a picture of the snowflake.
Yes.
Snowflake is the first category.
Yeah.
Okay. And thermal convection is the second category.
Or maybe it's some of both, I don't know.
Well, vegetable viruses, CCMV, is the first
one. I'm making connection to the physics of the previous life.
Okay, and another way you can be out of equilibrium is that you have a material which is built out of like components, and each of those components are kind of using energy to like do stuff. And so here, energy is being input at the microscopic level. It's like the actual molecules are kind of like, using energy to do stuff. And so basically the way you could think about it is that you have some material made out of molecules where the individual constituents are violating detailed balance kind of locally, you know, on their own. Yes.
In scenario one, if you were to make a movie, it would be really clear which way is forward, which way is backwards. In scenario two, can we run the movie backwards and forwards and not be able to?
No. So in general, like any of these things can be, I mean, you know, obviously there's, you know, many different unique ways of any of these sub ones, but in general, you know, forwards and back would look different in any of these.
I see.
One, you know, like huge example of active matter is the cytoskeleton, right? And so in a cytoskeleton, so for example, the stuff which I work on is a lot of stuff with microtubules. So you have filaments, and you have little motors, and those motors they hydrolyze ATP, as we all know, and that causes them to walk on microtubules and exert forces and make stuff, you know, move around. And so that's obviously violating detailed balance, which they can do because they're hydrolyzing ATP.
So you have given us three categories. I assume this is the full list.
No, this is just three random subsets. Yeah.
So my question is, where does life come into?
Well, and so this is what I'm saying is that, so basically, essentially all of cell biology is like, is this. I mean, the other things may also be, those other two things are also happening in biology all the time. But like, nearly any cellular structure, so like I'll talk a little bit more, like I work on the spindle, that's a very clear example of being out of equilibrium in this type of way. But it's essentially like anything you see inside of the cell is out of equilibrium in this type of way, to some first approximation.
Dan,
yeah.
On the active matter, although it is energy is at the microscopic level, the energy must have inputted through the boundaries early on, or stored.
No, so you could think about, like, imagine in this particular case, you have kind of ATP is out of equilibrium with its breakdown products, ADP and PI, mm-hmm. and that's like uniformly everywhere.
So
in your system.
So the system is filled with ATP.
Yeah, so your system is spatially filled with ATP, and obviously that could also be spatially varying, but like here, you know, you can often pretend to some good approximation that that's kind of spatially uniform,
So, but they have to come from somewhere else is what I was trying to.
Yeah. And so somehow, like.
They've been created by some external source.
Yeah.
Just to clarify on the question, is the thing associated with the fact that I need a source for driving, is the source local versus global?
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Local meaning?
Let's say at the boundary.
Okay.
So there
boundary
is a spatial structure to my source versus I don't have any spatial structure to my source. There is clearly a source.
Mm-hmm.
Is that helpful? Does that
yes. So it's a volume source versus a boundary
surface.
Yes.
Yeah. I wonder if you or anyone else here would know, how good is that approximation of uniform ATP concentration across the cell if it's being made in the mitochondria or God knows where?
In cells, that's a very good approximation.
Very good. Thank you.
Well, I mean, obviously, like in different components, you know, like inside mitochondria versus outside, it can be very different. But like in the cytoplasm, okay. Uniform.
So
okay. Well, I don't know in extreme cases like in neurons or something like that. But for certainly most cells, I'm sorry, something else.
Thanks.
Probably worth strengthening. I mean, probably worth making this point more loud because that's actually energy supply is very different in living system and non-living system. Like, you have to plug in the wall, right? You get the power, whereas the power is everywhere. So you don't need the power supply.
Sorry, I don't quite see it that way. Because battery is something that you could have a battery source, and you are not plugging in, but you store it.
Yeah.
You get the energy charge early on.
Yeah, you can charge it anyway, but then you distribute it, right?
Yeah, my point is plugged in, which may not be the...
Plugging is the wrong analogy.
Okay, so this is one of my favorite examples of active matter in vivo. So this is the spindle, which segregates chromosomes during cell division. So this is what my lab mostly works on, or one of the main things my lab works on. This is, I think, a fantastic example of active matter. This structure is largely composed of microtubules, like I was showing before, plus molecular motors, which are moving those microtubules relative to each other all the time, plus microtubules are growing and shrinking. And so, like, you can think of the spindle. So a spindle like this, well, this one probably has of order 10,000 microtubules in it. Other spindles have maybe 100,000. And they're very, very dynamic, and somehow you get this structure and this process. So that's one of the main things which I work on, and other people obviously work on that as well. You can also have active matter in vitro, and so this is a movie from Zvonimir's lab, where his group took microtubules and molecular motors, so just some of the components, which for example make up this, and just mix them up just in a test tube. And then you get these really cool, complicated flowing patterns. All right, so that's active matter in vitro. All right, so a lot of work, people have done a lot of work in active matter, and a lot of that is about trying to understand the mechanics and dynamics of these type of systems, and that's also what I've done. Like I said, mostly for me personally, stuff in cells or cell extracts in this kind of very complicated context of spindles, for me personally. But what I'm going to talk about now is gotten interested in what we're all here for, is the energetics of these things as well. So trying to understand the thermodynamic flows that ultimately drive these non-equilibrium behaviors. All right, so for me, I have like two large motivations for like why I got interested in this stuff. One is that it's cool. and I think it's just interesting from just this fundamental understanding of active matter and cell biology. And the other is that many diseases are actually thought to be caused by problems with energy metabolism. And so, for example, it's been hypothesized in different contexts, but particularly related to human infertility, that mitochondrial defects could lead to chromosome segregation errors. So somehow you screw up mitochondria, and that causes problems with the spindle. All right. So that's another reason why it's potentially interesting to study this connection. And so then that leads to, in my mind, at least two sets of like broad questions. Is one is about what I'll call like energy consumption. So like how much energy is used by the cytoskeleton, either in this kind of in vitro self-organization stuff or in the spindle, and what is that energy used for? How much energy is due to spindle assembly versus signaling versus anything else? And then the other is, what's the impact of varying these like energetic fluxes? And so how does varying energy metabolism or these thermodynamic fluxes impact cytoskeletal and spindle self-organization and behaviors? And so I'll just give an example of this. And so this is, again, like stuff which, like I said, Jingbo and Cullum, who's another postdoc on Lamb, did. So perturbing mitochondrial metabolism impacts spindle assembly. All right, so mitochondria require oxygen, right, as we know, to run the electron transport chain. In mouse oocytes, and as we learned in many other oocytes, they basically get all their energy using oxidative phosphorylation. So that means that if you fool with oxygen levels, you can fool with, you can perturb mitochondria. Right, here's a movie there's a spindle mouse oocyte. If you decrease oxygen levels, the spindle disassembles. You raise it, it reassembles.
What was the time scale?
2 hours.
Hopefully he doesn't put the timestamps in the movie.
I'm just too lazy to do that, but yeah. Yes. Yeah. But yeah, should do that. Okay, so this shows, okay, so decreasing oxygen in mass oocytes causes reversible spindle disassembly. Right, okay, it's...
And what's the fractional change in oxygen?
Oh, this is huge. This is going
from,
down.
From 5% to almost 0%.
Right, so
the atmosphere is 21%.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
What is the physiological oxygen concentration in the mouse, in the developing mouse?
I think it's around 2% probably, right?
Physiological, I mean in vivo?
Mm-hmm.
That I'm not exactly sure.
I know, like in human, it's 2%. Around 2%. Okay, so I mean, I think...
It depends on where, I guess. It can be almost 21 in the lungs or something,
yes.
Or it can be very low in the brain. It's a very large range.
But where, again, in human I know, like where the oocytes are, people say it's...
Where the oocytes, maybe
2, yeah.
So how do you know it's oxygen? I mean, I know you changed the oxygen, but you're referring that it's ATP.
No. So the mechanism is unclear. Yeah, no idea. Yeah. So it could be ATP. Mitochondria do many, many things. And even if it is ATP, it could be directly relevant, i.e. it could be like, oh, because the spindle's using ATP, or it could be because in order to maintain the pH of the cell, you're using ATP, and then maybe you perturb pH, right? So this could be like crazy indirect. So that we have no idea. But at least it shows you that there is, you know, you screw up mitochondria and you can screw up the spindle, whatever the mechanism is. So then the question you guess is like, well, how do you figure out the mechanism? So like, there are many approaches you could take. In my mind, the way to ask this question, and also to ask it more, not just in this particular case of this movie, but also, you know, like I said, like in reproductive biology, a lot of people believe that this is actually relevant for human infertility, you know, that screwing up mitochondria causes problems with the spindle. Is that true or not? That's unclear. That's just a hypothesis. You know, how do you ask that question? So how do you figure out if that is correct or not? And so my mind, the way that I guess I'm interested in attacking this problem personally, is trying to get a quantitative understanding of mitochondrial metabolism and a quantitative understanding of the spindle and how they respond to bioengineered things, and then try to use that quantitative understanding to figure out what's going on. So for me, that's like the big picture.
And then mechanism will be clear?
Well,
at
so...
the end of your talk, we will know.
No, definitely not. We're not on this step one. We're on this step one. We're not completed step one yet.
Can I just share in the mitonuclear sort of hypomorph we have that
yes.
knocks down OXPHOS activity?
Yes.
So we think the major reason that the embryo, during embryogenesis, we see a lot of death. And so we've studied the cell biology and they have disorganized mitotic spindles.
Cool. I like it. Yeah, let's talk more.
Huh. Oh, flag for some.
Okay. So then, I'll tell you kind of two stories which are at least vaguely related to this. One is about trying to understand endogenesis of the cytoskeleton in vitro. The other is trying to understand the mitochondrial metabolism in mouse oocytes. All right. So I'll start with the first one. All right. So the idea is to, like I just said, understand something about the thermodynamics of cytoskeletal organization in vitro. And then to do this, we used a really amazing instrument developed by Jos Vlasek and Jin He. Jos is also at Harvard. Jin He was a postdoc with Jos. Now she's a professor at UCSD. And what they did is that they developed an amazing calorimeter which has a picowatt resolution. So it's an incredibly sensitive calorimeter. You basically you put your sample on a pad. You have a reference sample on another pad. These two pads are connected by metal junctions. If they're at slightly different temperatures, you get a voltage, which you can measure, and then you can tell the temperature difference, essentially. And so you can figure out how much heat your sample is creating compared to a reference. All right. So then what we did, or what Peter and Bez did, was they took a sample from Zvonimir's group, and they took a droplet of this stuff and put it on the calorimeter. All right, so this is, yeah.
What is the volume approximately of the chamber?
And so it's like a half a microliter sample. And so this is an image of the entire sting of the, you know, this is the entire sample basically. So this is a mixture of microtubules, so purified mixture of microtubules and molecular motors, and there's a crowding agent PEG. So this is kind of like the thing I showed you before, but before the sample was kind of on a surface and then it got pneumatically aligned. Here, this is more kind of a 3D gel, which is kind of active. And so if you take a movie, it's doing all sorts of like crazy stuff. All right. Here, there's a timestamp.
That's fine. And a scaler.
And a scaler, yeah. All right. Okay. So when they do this measurement, okay, so then they can measure the total output from this sample. And it's of order 10 nanowatts.
Hours and minutes.
The 1 hour movie total. Maybe it's like minutes and seconds.
Let's look at 56. Oh, okay. And what is PEG doing? Just slowing down?
No. And so it's causing a depletion attraction, which is helping the microtubules form bundles. And then the motors are working on the bundles.
Do you have any estimate for how this compares with maybe the energy of the microtubule, the kinetic energy, and all the other?
Excellent question. Let's think about that. Okay, so how much dissipation is associated with large-scale motions, which we see under the microscope?
Is it ATP in?
Oh, yes. Yeah. All this is.
How much does it run out?
Oh, yeah. So this has, and this will be important later. So this has what people call an ATP regeneration system. So you put an ATP, but you couple to another chemical reaction to essentially fix the ATP level for a long period of time. So in this standard condition, what's the ATP concentration?
It's 1.5 millimolar.
Okay. And that'll be fixed for quite a while. Okay. So how much dissipation is associated with those large-scale motions with the movie we're playing you would see and be impressed by?
Okay. You have motors inside too, right?
Oh, yeah, and it's the motors which is causing that motion.
But the ATP, I mean, the outside pump you have ATP, but the motors will also give you the ATP generation. No. The inside, you know.
No. Yeah, the motors use ATP, hydrolyzed ATP to make ADP.
That's what I mean. But wouldn't the motors utilize the ATP that inside that generated inside, or you have to supply the ATP?
No. Sorry. So this is an in vitro system. So there's only there what you put in purified chemicals. If all you did was just put in, you know, 1 millimolar ATP, very rapidly the motors would use up all the ATP and then you'd have no ATP, right? So one trick which people do in systems like this is that you and I'll talk a little bit more about this later, but you have another chemical reaction which is using up something else. So whenever the motors hydrolyze an ATP, you convert that ADP back to ATP by running out some other chemical. So you're essentially fixing ATP levels at 1 millimolar by using up some other chemical.
Does that generate heat?
Yeah.
Yes. but okay. But the first thing we're going to ask is just from the large scale motions, like how much heat do we expect to come from that? So Peter and Bez did PIV, which is essentially just a technique for measuring these flows. Using image processing, and so they can measure the velocity of the flows, they can measure the length scale of the flows. Zvonimir, in collaboration with Dan Blair, has done rheology on samples like this, and at these time scales, the samples are approximately water, and obviously, you know, the size of the sample. And so you can just do essentially back of the envelope calculation. So we know, you know, based on this thing, you know, being in a fluid, we know roughly, you know, what the viscous dissipation should be per unit volume, which you can just, you know, estimate from these, you know, from this flow pattern which is measured.
Do you know what is its Reynolds number?
Very, very, very low. I don't know the exact thing, but very, very, very low.
Because here it looks very turbulent.
Yes, yes, yeah, which is kind of the cool thing, because it's like because of this activity, this is one of the cool things about these systems, because of this activity, you're getting this kind of turbulent-like behavior, even though this is low Reynolds number.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So should I be worried that everything depends on the geometry and the system size? Because I guess you want to say that you can rescale by the volume and get the...
No. I just want to do a calculation of what I think for this particular droplet, which is the exact same thing that's in the calorimeter, how much heat is associated with these flows, which we see in this movie. Like, if you change sample size, the velocity could change, the length scale of the flows could change, even the viscosity could change, as far as I know.
Do you have a sense of how would they scale?
And so Zvonimir does. And so they definitely do. I believe for their larger sample size, the flows get faster, right?
Yes.
And does the length scale also get larger? I don't know.
Yes.
Yes, and so they increase. but here we're talking about for this particular droplet here. I'm not talking about how this scales the size.
10^-6 is Reynolds, by the way.
Okay, 10^-6 Reynolds number, so small. All right, so you can plug in those numbers to estimate the amount of dissipation associated with these large-scale flows, and you get about 10^-7 nanowatts. Okay, so 10^-7 is smaller than 10.
Another question occurred to me based on this Reynolds number of 1 in a million. Are there large thermal gradients in there?
No.
Then nothing does.
No. No, heat diffuses super fast, and these are relatively slow motions.
The flow really looks unstructured and yet turbulent.
Yeah, yeah, but that has to do with all these molecular motors, like kind of exerting forces and doing stuff, yeah. Yeah,
I'm wondering where is it manifesting, if it's not in turbulence and if it's not in heat. What can explain that motion as chaotic?
Oh, yeah, like why you get that pattern of motion in particular. So certain people study this, and other people who know more can comment on these type of things, yeah.
Christina, did you want to say something?
Well, I mean, why is the motion chaotic even though the essentially this energy input, this local energy input drives instabilities of these local regions and drives vorticity as a matter of fact on scales that are of the order of these 100 micrometers here.
It's a slightly longer answer to.
So what the conclusion from this calculation is basically, so essentially, a minuscule amount of the power that's being used goes into these large scale flows. Right, just an insanely, insanely small number. I mean, so like before, when we were starting this experiment, I thought it was going to be a small number, and I thought, oh, it'll be 10% or 1%, right? But this is like way smaller than that.
Right? Maybe I can just say, so essentially it's a system that shears itself. You have an energy input local that drives local shear. And it's a system that shears itself, as opposed to shearing it from the outside.
So then probably the dimensionless scaling parameter is neither Reynolds number or Rayleigh number, but there must be something else. That's going
in. You can use a number called something called Ericsson number.
Can I ask another question? So in turbulence, there is this notion of direct cascade and inverse cascade. Mm-hmm. So do you have a sense of at what scale is energy dissipated, or are you getting
it? Well, I mean, me personally? So certainly people have thought about those issues.
We should let them go on.
So there is some sense in the literature. Ask Christina afterwards.
Yeah. But is this relevant for this point?
No, the calculation that he did is okay.
It's okay, but it depends on the assumptions.
So I don't feel it's a little bit.
Yeah, I think we should just let that go on.
My question, is there any friction between the fibers?
Is there any friction between the fibers? Yeah, presumably, yes. Yes. Okay, but the essentially minuscule dissipation is associated from these large-scale flows, right? So then the question is, or one question is, so why is there such a low efficiency of the system for generating large-scale flows? So you put in a huge amount of energy into the system, or the system is dissipating a huge amount of energy, but very little of that is going into large-scale flows.
Why do you say efficiency for dissipation magnitude?
Well, because I mean that, like, the system is using this amount of energy, and then the amount of energy associated with these large-scale flows is small.
Is the calorimetry measuring the amount of energy the system is using up or the amount of heat the system is producing?
Well, it's measuring the amount of heat the system is producing, but those... And so, like, it's true, like, there's, like, the, I guess, like, this is, like, associated with, like, how much heat you get from every ATP hydrolysis, essentially. Maybe I'm not quite sure.
I'm thinking D is DW plus DQ, and you're measuring DQ.
So it's the upper bound. So, but you see this 10 to minus 8, so whatever is not being worked is very, very, very tiny, so the heat is...
That's right.
Not possibly energy.
Yeah, that's what I thought. You have actually shown that the P flow is so small, all the heat is going into this turbulence type vortex flow.
No, none of that is. All is going to heat, not this turbulent flow.
No, but not the large scale, Dan. But there are a lot of small scale eddies. Which are diffuse.
Okay, so this is now a hypothesis. This is now a hypothesis of where stuff is going.
We will learn now. You're going to
tell us the calorimetry of all of the reactions that are going on, right?
Well, you'll see what I'll tell you. Okay, so one thought which we had about what might be going on is that you could have non-cross-linking motors. So, because the thing is that... whenever a motor walks, it's using ATP. If you have a motor in solution that's not walking, it's not using ATP. But you could have motors like this guy over here, who's not cross-linking microtubules, but can still walk on them and would still use ATP and would still, you know, generate heat, but wouldn't be producing any flows. So we thought, oh, maybe it's those guys. Maybe you just have a lot of those guys, and that's why, you know, like stuff is happening. All right, because that guy hydrolyzes ATP, but doesn't slide microtubules. Okay. So then the idea is to remove that subpopulation of motors and repeat the experiment. Okay. So, and Zvonimir's group developed a system that allows one to do that. So basically, instead of having these motor clusters which can cross-link, which can like, you know, diffuse around and bind microtubules and cross-link guys, they developed a different system where what they're able to do is attach one side of a motor to a microtubule. So this guy's now kind of permanently attached here and has its feet, or heads as they're called, for no reason, I guess, sticking up. And so now, if you're in a situation like this, right, this guy over here isn't going to hydrolyze ATP because it's not cross-linked to any microtubule. Right? Only this guy is going to hydrolyze ATP. And so in this system, everyone who's hydrolyzing ATP is cross-linking. However, even in this system, the flows are basically the same, and the heat dissipation is essentially the same. All right. So that means it wasn't these other non-cross-linking motors. They basically weren't contributing anything.
So Dan, is there a way you are tracking the qualitative nature of the flow? To say that they are, like, I mean, are there any?
Yeah, and so Peter and Bezza, they do PIV, and then they calculate basically just velocity, kind of a correlation length and the velocity, and the average velocity. So that's kind of what we mean by, like, the flows are the same. Okay. Essentially, the velocity is the same, and the length scale of the flows is the same, basically. Okay, so that's not the explanation. All right, so then Okay, so then, you know, we were confused. And so then we asked a different question, just like, how can the dissipation be accounted for? Let's just kind of ask that question, all right? And so then Peter developed a simple chemical kinetic model of this, of what's going on in this system. All right, so I mentioned before that, you know, motors are hydrolyzing ATP, and there's also this ATP regeneration system here, right? So then whenever you hydrolyze ATP, this guy takes some PEP, converts it to pyruvate, and by doing that, it turns the ADP into ATP. So this is how you essentially fix ATP levels in this system. All right, so then basically, so Peter developed a model assuming that everything is well mixed and that all the motors are just kind of doing their thing. All right, so what do I mean by that? I mean, okay, so in other words, we're just kind of going around this, you know, like just running this process in a spatial uniform sense. All right, so the amount of dissipation, the heat that's produced, is the the energy per reaction times the number of reactions per second. In this system, you can say, okay, so it depends on the total size of the system, and then you have kind of two reactions. One is associated with what the kinesin is doing. The other is what this regeneration system is doing. And then you have some energy that's released when you run those reactions. And then you can have a model of that whole thing, including not only the fact that these reactions, kinesin is using ATP, but the fact that it's that the motors need to bind to microtubules. And then Peter just used essentially Kael-Smeaton kinetics for the two enzymes in the system, which are kinesin and pyruvate kinase. And the thing, so these are very well characterized enzymes, very well characterized system, which means that Peter knows all of the parameters in the literature. So you can just kind of look up all these numbers, right? So then he does so. and then we want to know, okay, like, you know, is this model right? Can this explain the dissipation in the system? And it tested that by investigating how dissipation depends on the total amount of ATP. And so this is a plot. These are data for dissipation, you know, measured different samples at different ATP levels. This is the prediction of the model. And again, this is not a fit. This is just, you know, numbers from literature, right? And I would say that, I would say this agrees. and so in other words, this describes amount of dissipation as a function of ATP. All right, again, not a fit at all.
For this calculation, you take the amount of kinesin as all the kinesin in the solution.
Yes, that's right.
But there are kinesins that are not bound to the microtubule, therefore it's not burning.
Yeah, evidently that's a very... in order to burn, you have to be
you
bound.
You can count it.
Yes.
You have to bind. Burn.
Yeah.
Okay. And so I imagine the kinesins aren't experiencing a large load, where a large load would probably reduce their rates of ATP consumption. So they're swimming freely, let's say. They're walking without much hindrance.
That's right.
Okay.
And did you actually try to do an experiment where you just put microtubules and single-headed kinesins so there's no motion, and does that change anything? Or?
So you did the calibration.
It with just regular kinesin heads.
And you get the same data.
So we didn't do the ATP suite, but you get roughly similar numbers.
Okay.
So quick question about the biological significance of this energy being produced. It seems to be almost all the energy you're measuring seems to be energy from waste energy from a reaction, maybe. that be?
So some of the energy is coming from, some of the heat is associated with ATP hydrolysis, mm-hmm. and some is associated with the regeneration system. So this is just, in other words, you could, like in this context, this is essentially a way of measuring reaction rates, if you will.
I have a question on the data uncertainty, like high ATP concentration.
Yeah.
What is the reason for that?
That has to do with errors from replicates. So that just means, yeah, that's just a...
I was thinking it will be higher, lower concentration.
No, I think that's more having to do with kind of experimental issues. Okay, so what about that was titrating ATP? You can titrate other components. The same model. So then Peter and Bez titrated tubule concentration, and again, same model. Again, just with measure, you know, parameters from the literature, not a fit. You know, explains the effect of changing microtubule concentration as well. Okay, so basically, the other component in the system is motors. What happens when titrating those? The model fails. Okay, so like what this model would predict basically is essentially a linear increase in dissipation with concentration of motors. That's not, so that's true, that's what's observed for small motor concentration. That's not what, that does not happen at larger motor concentration. So something's going on. We don't know what's happening. One possibility is that you're getting some type of traffic jams on the microtubules, which so the motors are kind of interfering with each other and therefore slowing down. But we actually don't know. That's just a hypothesis.
Well, if you do motility assay, you see that at very high densities there is no motility.
Yeah, so that's,
and it's not really a traffic jam. It's just that these are precessive motors. Right?
So they're like they're interfering with each other.
So they're like increasing friction as opposed to active stress.
Say that again.
Yeah, it's a little unclear how that.
I mean, a motor takes only a microsecond to step. Then it waits for a millisecond to make another step, as far as I understand, right? So most of the time, it acts as a passive crosslinker, right? And if I have many, many motors.
Oh, it's inter microtubule friction.
Yes. If you have met, if they're all elastically coupled to each other, right?
It could be, yeah. On one hand, I understand. On the other hand, I find it kind of confusing, but they definitely, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's saying they don't step synchronously.
Yeah. Yes. But it's still like unclear to me, like how that, why that gives you that everyone slows down when you have a lot. I mean.
Okay. Like a start. It becomes a crossing network, so they start. They exert stresses, but they don't generate motion.
I'm not saying it's not true. I mean, like on one hand, I understand the argument, but at least for me, I find that a little bit confusing, is all I'm saying. Yeah.
Can you do the control that you were talking about earlier, where you have just the heaviest heads?
Oh, and then a very high concentration?
Yeah,
actually, that would be a good experiment. That we haven't done. That's a good, very good idea. Okay, so then I'll just say the summary for this part. All right, so then, so large-scale motions in the system are a very minor source of dissipation, and a very simple chemical model, which you could argue is basically assuming nothing interesting is happening, can describe mostly everything, except for the effect of motor concentration, which is more happening. This still doesn't answer the question, why is the efficiency of generating large-scale motion so low? We have some hypotheses about that, and I suggest you talk to Peter if you want to learn what we're thinking, but it doesn't answer that question.
Just a trivial question.
Yeah.
On average, in your model or your understanding, on a microtubule of lens or a micron,
yes.
How many, in your model, how many kinesins are there at any moment?
You'd have to ask Peter that. How many kinesins per microtubule under whatever, you know, standard conditions?
How many motors per microtubule?
So I can tell you it's like 250 nanomolar is the concentration of kinesin, and it's about 20 micromolar of microtubules. Isn't that super
awesome?
Yeah,
you and I did this.
Yeah, we did
I'll
this.
Tell you guys in a few minutes.
I don't think I'll cut out wrong.
We did this.
Yeah.
I think the mean spacing one is 100 nanometers.
Yeah.
The mean spacing of motors like less than 100. But I'll repeat.
Yeah, so it's about 10-ish. Okay, that's not too
many. But like one of the lessons which I like from this, I think personally, is that naively, you know, you might say, hey, look, I have this system moving around, I see it under the microscope, I'm going to estimate the amount of energy that it costs to do that. And if you did that calculation, you know, like that is very, very different from the amount of energy the system is using. So in my mind, I think that's kind of a note of caution, basically. Okay.
Yeah, you'd be completely wrong.
Yes. Yeah, you'd be wrong by, you know, a factor of 100 million.
So can you use that, like, can you put spindles in there?
Oh, so that's where we're going towards. Yeah. That type of thing.
That's going to be amazing.
Okay, so now I'll tell you about the second bit, which is, you know, focused on stuff that, like I said, Jingbo and other people might have been doing, mostly work that Jingbo has been doing. Okay, and the idea is, again, to try to understand biophysics of mitochondrial metabolism in vivo. Okay. And basically, we want to have a... So, obviously, people know a lot about mitochondrial metabolism. You know, like, there's a huge amount of work on the enzymes involved, very, very well studied. But we want to kind of have a more like a systems level understanding. In other words, the goal is to be able to, you know, have some type of phenomenological understanding. So where one can relate quantitative measurements that you can do in cells to a theory you have and actually have, try to have a predictive theory. That's kind of the goal. And so in order to, you know, I guess we believe is that in order to like kind of achieve that goal, you need kind of two things. You need some quantitative measurements of mitochondrial metabolism in vivo, and you need some quantitative theory of mitochondrial metabolism. And so that's what we're headed for. So what I'll tell you is more about this, but the idea is to do this in service of eventually that. And we're kind of partly there. almost there. Okay, and so the technique that we use, which we're going to hear, Michelle's going to talk a lot more about, I believe tomorrow, is metabolic imaging of NADH and FAD. NADH and FAD are central to mitochondrial metabolism. So essentially, nearly all ATP production is associated with, you know, redox reactions associated with those guys. And ends up that they're autofluorescent, all right? So it just happens to be the case, I don't know, like God was kind to us. And NADH is autofluorescent, NAD is not. And FAD is autofluorescence, but FADH is not. That's how it is. And it also ends up that if you choose proper excitation and emission wavelengths, you can essentially measure the fluorescence of these guys in cells, right? So you can really isolate where you can arrange stuff so your signal's overwhelmingly coming from those two molecules. So one thing which a lot of people do is that they do that. They look at the intensity of fluorescence from those two molecules, and they try to use that to understand metabolism. That's a very powerful approach, but it's still, you could argue, kind of not quite good enough. And so we use another technique, and again, this is what, like I said before, Michelle has done a huge amount of work on this, and she'll tell us a lot about it tomorrow. But we use a technique, like I said, the same technique which she'll talk about, called fluorescence lifetime imaging microscopy, or FLIM. And there are many ways to do FLIM. The particular version that we do is called time-correlated single photon counting. And you could think of it as follows. So you have a pulsed laser. For people who know this stuff, this is a two-photon microscope, and it's the same lasers you use for a two-photon microscope, a Thai sapphire laser. And you have a pulse, comes in the microscope, hits your fluorophore gets in that excited state, relaxes, emits a photon, and you detect that photon. And then you have very fast electronics, so you generate one pulse from your laser, and maybe, you know, like 3.8 nanoseconds later, you detect a photon. The next pulse comes in from the laser, no photons. Next pulse comes in, no photons. Next pulse comes in, and 1.879 nanoseconds later, you see a photon. And so what you can do then is that you can collect data from a lot of photons, and you can make a histogram of photon arrival times. And this is basically the distribution of times that your molecule's in the excited state. And like I said, so we're using a Thai sapphire laser, which is 80 megahertz, so you're doing 80 million pulses a second. So you can build up these histograms relatively quickly. And the idea is that, so, and this is like a microscopy, right? So normally with microscopy, you know, you have some image, and at every pixel, you have a certain number of photons. Here, at every pixel, you have a histogram of photon arrival times. All right. So now, and so then a lot of people do metabolic imaging of NADH with FLIM, and that's what we do. That's what we do as well. And then the reason this is such a powerful technique is that NADH, the lifetime of NADH, depends on whether it's bound to a protein or whether it's soluble. All right? So basically, so like you can do stuff like the following. If you have a mouse oocyte, this is a image from, you know, FLIM NADH. This is what NADH, this is what it looks like. If you do an intensity one, then if you group all the photons you have in this image together, you can get a histogram like this of photon arrival times. And then basically, you can see that this data here is fit to, also just a second, a sum of two exponentials. And again, people do different analysis, and like I said, Michelle's going to talk about, I'm sure, a different way of dealing with FLIM data, the way that we deal with it, which is similar to other people as well, or some other people as well, is that so we know that the fast decay, so free NADH has a very short lifetime, well, enzyme-bound NADH has a very long lifetime. So basically, you take this data, you fit it to a sum of two exponentials, and when you do that, the ratio of these two exponentials tells you about the fraction of NADH bound to enzymes.
Is this bound state that is bound to enzymes, is this a long-lived state, or does it oscillate?
So definitely the things will be binding, unbinding, and stuff
on,
like that.
On the scale of nanoseconds, or?
No. Yeah, that's much longer time scales than this, yeah.
Is the initial 2 nanosecond of any significance?
Oh, no. This is just some experimental artifact where this histogram is kind of shifted by some arbitrary amount. So for example, you could say it this way. I mean, you have a pulse comes in, and then that kind of, it's a little more complicated than this. We can pretend it's working like this. This kind of pulse comes in, and that kind of triggers a signal, which you then are going to, No, let me not say that. Okay, I'll just say, no, it's just an experimental thing, yeah. Okay, so now you can measure the fraction of NADH bound to enzymes in living cells, and from the intensity, you can get the concentration of NADH, again, in living cells. All right, and so then what we do is that, so we know redox reactions in mitochondria and cytoplasm are very, very different. So we segment out where the mitochondria are. And so we know, and then we validated this, and so have other people in different contexts, that basically the bright stuff here is mitochondria. The dim stuff here is cytoplasm. So you can segment out, and you can look at signal coming from mitochondria versus signal coming from cytoplasm. Okay. And so from everything I'm going to say for the rest of this talk, we're talking about doing FLIM on NADH, and I may or may not talk about FAD at all. I think it's just NADH I'll talk about, in mitochondria. So then what we're going to be measuring is basically fraction of NADH bound to enzymes in mitochondria and concentration of NADH in mitochondria. Okay. So again, so the goal is to do quantitative measurements and try to quantitatively understand something. So you need to do some type of quantitative perturbation. And the perturbation which Jingbo and other people in lab have done a lot of is manipulating oxygen levels. Because like I said before, the electron transport chain needs oxygen, and oxygen concentration you can control very well. All right, so for example, you can have the oocytes in a chamber and then drop oxygen slowly over time and then recover it back to the baseline. So this is just oxygen concentration, you know, that the oocytes are seeing as a function of time. And if you take a movie of that, you can see that, I mean, from the movie, you see the intensity of mitochondria and actually cytoplasm too is changing as you're changing oxygen levels. All right, so the goal now, right now, is trying to understand this type of thing.
So what is the A mitochondria?
Say again? All this bright stuff is mitochondria.
All bright stuff.
Yeah.
So are we thinking, are talking about hundreds?
Or? Oh, a number of mitochondria. Yeah, so these are not individual mitochondria. These are kind of like aggregates of mitochondria. Yeah.
Are you also labeling the mitochondria, or you're just inferring that that's where the mitochondria are?
Yeah, and so here we're just inferring that. We and other people have done experiments where you also use MitoTracker, and then you compare to this, and then you see that they're the same. Yeah. Okay, so then you can do stuff like okay, now you can just ask, okay, how does intensity and radiation in mitochondria change as a function of oxygen level? And how does the NADH-bound ratio change as a function of oxygen level? And these are how they do that. Okay. Okay. But ultimately, the point is interpreting this response requires some type. I would argue, and Jingbo would argue as well, that this interpreting this would require some type of model. Yeah.
Is this data collected from your oocyte, or isolated
one? No. This is no. Yeah. So like, it would do very oxygen. Like NADH does not respond. Isolated NADH does not respond. Yeah. So this is something special is happening in the mitochondria. Yeah.
The absolute amounts of NADH bound stay approximately the same. Is that right? Just
the concentration of NADH bound. The concentration of NADH bound.
Almost flat.
Okay.
So
my question.
Okay, so what we claim is that to interpret this, you need some type of model. All right, so.
So maybe I kind of follow up. The NADH bound ratio is the concentration of NADH bound divided by concentration of NADH free.
Multiply the two curves, the constant.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so a lot of other people have made models of mitochondrial metabolism. At least the ones I'm familiar with tend to be very, very complicated and have many equations with many unknown parameters. And so while they could be helpful, they can be helpful for certain contexts, it makes it very difficult to test these models or relate them to measurements such as the one that Jingbo has done. So the question is, can we develop a predictive biophysical model of mitochondrial metabolism that one can use to interpret those type of measurements? All right. And so, here is like the outline of the grand unified model of oocyte metabolism. Okay, so it just abstract. So this is how mitochondria work in some very broad sense. And, all right, so you have NADH. Oh, sorry, you have NAD plus, and then the Krebs cycle, converts that to NADH. The electron transport chain takes NADH and takes it to NAD plus. When it does that, it takes hydrogen ions from inside the mitochondria, puts them out. Side of the mitochondria, those hydrogen ions can leak back in, or you can run ATP synthase, and when you do that, you the hydrogen ions go back in, and at the same time, ADP goes to ATP, and then the cell does stuff, and that makes ATP go to ADP. So you have these three coupled loops, and so then the idea is that we want to make kind of a quantitative version of this model. And then, so here now we're talking about NADH measurements, and that's where we've made the most progress so far, and that's what's required to relate to FLIM measurements. And so then here's our model of, or Jingbo's model of this NADH cycle. Okay, so basically, so he's treating essentially all of the electron transport chain as one big enzyme, and all of the Krebs cycle as another big enzyme. All right? And then, and this, I should say, this is now a modified version we did previously because of probing from people who know stuff, including most recently Dennis. This is a modified version we had before. And so in this version, NADH, you know, can now, it can freely, you know, it can bind to either of these enzymes. NAD plus can bind to either of these enzymes. And those are both reversible reactions. And then in this model, we're saying, okay, but the electron transport chain under the conditions which we're saying is irreversible. And the Krebs cycle is also irreversible. That's what we're saying under our conditions, which seems reasonable. All right, so now we're going to start analyzing this model and use it to interpret experiments. All right, so just do the following. So let's consider one like node in this model. What's the flux kind of through here? Well, you have some like rate of forward stuff. That's just you know, at the concentration of this enzyme times that rate. Some rate of backward stuff, that's the NA concentration of NADH times this rate. Oh, sorry, I screwed my notation here. You can tell what the flux through to another node, similar thing, concentration of this guy and you know times the forward rate, concentration of this guy times the reverse rate. You can tell what the flux through this part, concentration of this guy times the rate of that reaction. And
sorry, this right-hand side, is it coupled to the proton translocation?
This is coupled to proton translocation. So this is going to depend on, like, everything in the world. This parameter is going to depend on oxygen, it's going to depend on membrane potential, it's going to depend on everything.
Okay, so you're not taking explicitly that into account.
And so here I'm just saying, I would say that we're not right now, I'm not noting what this depends on. But I'm just kind of this is a rate that depends on all that stuff. Okay. All right. Okay. So then, now at steady state, all these fluxes have to be equal. Right. That's true. So then one can just set all these things equal to each other. Then one can do some algebra and solve in this model for how the NADH bound ratio, which you experimentally measure with FLIM, depends on the parameters of the model. All right, and what you see from this, that this equation here is of the following form. This NADH bound ratio is some constant plus another constant times this reaction rate. And this constant right here, which we're calling K equilibrium, is the equilibrium and NADH bound ratio. That's saying in the absence of reaction. Yes?
Does this model take into account the preferred way that cells are breaking down glucose, or either going through the electron transport chain or doing through glycolysis?
So I would say like right now, so this is a model, the way we're saying right now, this is really for what's happening in the mitochondria. And I would say this is true irrespective. I mean, like, as long as this, you can kind of treat it at this kind of coarse grain level, this is kind of true irrespective of anything.
What about, like, succinate and that, like, complex 2? So you're just feeding in NADH, right? But there are other substrates of the electron transport chain.
Yes. And so here we're just talking, right. So good point, right? So, like, Here, here's one big assumption which we're going to make later. So, is that, if I want to relate this to really what the electron transport chain is doing, then I have to assume that it's only the electron transport chain which is oxidizing NADH, right? So, that's clearly not like rigorously true. The question is that kind of like true to a good enough approximation or not? And then here, we're also not talking about FAD at all. One would imagine that a different scheme, but we're interested in saying, well, what's the right scheme for FAD? It won't be this, because FAD is almost always covalently bound to things, and so you're not at least indifferent. But one could hope to build such a model for FAD as well.
So that equation assumes that all of the NADH reductases have NADH bound. So if that's the bound ratio, and you've got the concentrations of the enzymes.
So this is the bound ratio. This is the bound ratio. This is the thing which you measure in phlegm.
Right.
This is literally the concentration of NADH bound to these two enzymes divided by the total concentration of NADH.
So it's not the concentration of the enzymes, it's the concentration of NADH.
It's the concentration of NADH, yes, bound to the enzymes, not the concentration
of
the enzymes.
Not the concentration of the enzymes.
That's right.
Presumably, you should have a different qualitative behavior if the ROX is large and ROX is small. Quite different behavior.
Yes. And so here, maybe this is what you're alluding to. So here, we're assuming that, let's see, what's the question? ROX, that this is slow. This is slow.
The binding and unbinding.
Yeah, we're relative binding and unbinding, which is presumably good at. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So now the thing which is, I think, amazing about this very simple model is that it allows one to relate phlegm measurements to metabolic fluxes. All right. So let me elaborate on that. So the flux through the electron transport chain in this model is, you know, the concentration of NADH bound to oxidase times the rate that NADH is oxidized. So this is kind of true. This is true assuming, like I said before, that this is really that the oxidation of NADH is overwhelmingly happening from the electron transport chain. So that's the big assumption here, I would say, which I think is a good assumption. Now the thing is that so it ends up that. So you can solve for, you know, I showed you, you can kind of get a relationship for this quantity. You can also solve for this quantity in this model. And it ends up that this is proportional to this following stuff. Okay? Now, the thing which is amazing about this relationship right here is that these quantities are all things you can experimentally measure with phlegm. All right? So you can measure the concentration of NADH bound to enzymes with phlegm. You can measure the concentration of free NADH with phlegm. And this K equilibrium, you can measure if you drop oxygen to zero, then you're not running the electron transport chain, presumably you're in equilibrium, and hence you can get this parameter. So experimentally, if you drop oxygen to zero, then you can get this parameter. Then you can use this equation to tell you something which is proportional to flux through the electron transport chain. Now, okay, like, how do we know if this is true or not? Flux through the electron transport chain is also the oxygen consumption rate. So then what we can do is that we can measure the oxygen consumption rate as a function of oxygen, for example. We can use this equation to predict what the oxygen consumption rate should be from phlegm measurements, and we can ask, do those two things agree with each other? All right, so here is from that data which I was showing you before, the predicted OCR from phlegm as a function of oxygen. And here is an experimentally measured OCR rate. And again, this is not a fit. These are two independent measurements plotted on top of each other. Just two completely independent measurements. Okay. So
this is, you said it's normalized.
Yes, exactly.
When you normalize.
Exactly. And so ultimately, right, because phlegm is a steady state measurement. So in some sense, you can't get like a rate from it, if you will. So there's kind of a rate sitting out in front, which you don't know. And so that affects the scale of everything. Okay, so then this looks promising, I would say. and so then one can kind of now start to fool with stuff a little bit more. All right, so then now this is the next fooling with stuff. All right, so now if you really believe this model, the Flynn parameters don't only tell you the flux through this pathway, which is the same thing as oxygen consumption rate, but you can separately measure so not just the flux, which is the rate times the concentration of oxidase, immediate amount of oxidase, but in this model, you can measure those two things separately from Flynn. Right? So you can take, here's the control data, here's like what the reaction rate is, here's now this is 1 over the concentration of NADH oxidase, and you get the OCR rate by, you know, taking that and dividing by that, but whatever. But now you can ask, what happens if you start perturbing things? All right, so the first thing we're going to do, so we said this is what's happening. First thing we're going to do is we're going to ask what happens if you perturb supply. And by supply, I mean like this is like the input to this, all of this, well, certainly this loop, you know, stuff from the Krebs cycle. Right, so we want to kind of fool with that and then see what happens. So Zinko did all sorts of different measurements, you know, did different things. So he changes, you know, these guys ultimately are using pyruvate. He can change concentration of pyruvate. He can use oxamate, which is, pyruvate can be converted to lactate, and lactate can be converted to pyruvate. Oxamate blocks that reaction. Now, and then what you see, so with these different perturbations, you change, you know, you can change this ROX by a lot and NADH oxidase by a lot. But if you look at the predicted OCR by multiplying those two things together, those don't change. Okay, so you perturb oxamate, you change, you know, ROX, you change NADX inversely so that the predicted OCR stays the same. And in fact, if you go ahead and measure OCR, you see it's also the same, all right? So in other words, you perturb supply, I'm gonna say this once more, in all sorts of different ways. Perturbing supply apparently is impacting these rates and concentration, but not the flux. All right, and that's true both from this kind of, yeah, that's true. Okay. Now, what about changing demand? The same story. So, you know, so Jingbo did a bunch of different things, you know, tried to fool with, okay, you know, protein synthesis, you know, tries to block protein synthesis, disassembles a spindle, screws up actin, you know, does stuff to try to screw up memory potential. Those can have very large effects on, you know, like the what's going on at the redox metabolism level, you know, like ROX and NADH ox. But neither the calculated, you know, like predicted flux or the actual measured flux change at all. All right, so this argues in this system, right? Okay, so you could ask, you know, basically what determines flux through this pathway, right? It's not supply and it's not demand. That seems kind of weird. but
we have an intrinsic time scale. We do have an intrinsic time scale, which is
it. Maybe this is related to what you're saying, is that if you perturb stuff in the middle, the actual kind of like enzymes doing the stuff, by either making more leak by adding FCCP or screwing up ATP synthase, you know, this direction, then you can have a very large effect on flux.
Yeah, so I know this is something we were talking about the other day. So could this be explained by the fact that essentially, like I'm just thinking going back to your plot earlier where you showed sort of the, you know, it as a function of the oxygen concentration, and it seemed to sort of max out pretty quick. So, like, in Michaelis-Menten kinetics, right, you have this kind of maximum. So if the system has a really steep beginning, right, so that basically almost like zero over potential is required, which is actually consistent with a reversible chain, right, because zero over potential means as soon as you're changing the oxygen concentration, all of a sudden you're getting a change in flux, which means you can achieve that maximum relatively easily.
Okay, so I'll say something, and I think it's the same thing you were saying,
But
it may not be. So what Zingbo's idea currently is that, okay, so like the mitochondria, you know, one of their substrates is ADP, right? If you're saturated for ADP, then changing demand isn't going to do anything. because you change demand, you change ADP, but you're insensitive. You know, mitochondria, you know, like if you plot like how much, you know, oxygen consumption rate as a function of ADP levels, if you're at really high ADP levels, you've saturated ATP synthase and changing and
I think it might be the same thing.
Yeah, sounds like it's the same.
Yeah.
Okay, so that I think is really weird and interesting, personally. Okay, so then summary for this part. The combination of metabolic imaging with FLIM and a coarse-grained model allows measurements of metabolic fluxes and enzyme kinetics, if you believe it. Supply and demand impact the kinetics and concentration, but not fluxes. And it seems that leak in ATP synthase impacts fluxes. And then Jingo's working on the grand unified theory of all the other, you know, two loops. And so in a little bit, you know, we'll know everything.
Just curious if you used other inhibitors, enzyme inhibitors of the metabolic pathways. So, for example, 2DG or any of them that are used during the C-horse assay, which are the typical metabolic inhibitors.
Yeah, so you usually have a bunch of stuff. I don't remember.
Right, 2DG is for glycolysis. Mm-hmm. So now we're starting mostly mitochondria. So we're inhibiting different complexes in the enzyme transport chain, like rodina, that is inhibiting complex 1. Cyanide, that inhibits complex 4. All those definitely will change, you know, the flux. Because if you literally, like, kill that enzyme, and also the process will die. All that, right? So, yes.
And when you're dead, there's no flux, yeah. but one thing which I think is, in my mind, kind of like profound about this is that this question of like, so, you know, like I think, you know, we and I think other people here are interested in also asking about, you know, how much energy certain things take in the, you know, in the cell. And kind of one naive way to try to determine that is you inhibit some process, measure how that changes oxygen consumption rate, and associate that change with how much demand you were, you know, using. And that certainly might work in some context, but it wouldn't work in this context. And so this argues that that's, again, that maybe that works most of the time, I don't know, but it's clearly not universally, I mean, unless maybe it's a mistake, that's not universally true.
Is it possible, so maybe I'm not understanding your experiments, but from what I understand, your experiments were done on sort of a, like, maybe minutes time scale or something like that to reach the steady state. Right, so and you're talking about perturbing the middle. So I'm wondering, although changing like the respiration rate, as you're saying, doesn't really change the flux here, maybe if you changed it over a much longer time scale to allow essentially the machinery of the electron transport chain to like change like the relative concentrations of like complex 2 and 3, then you could change what that constant flux is over a longer time.
No, that's super interesting. So well, you want to comment on
this? If you are talking about developmental time scale, for sure things will change. We have actually, that's something we are studying, the kind of the metabolic trajectories over development. Like talking about days, things that will change for sure.
So here's metabolic imaging like of primitive embryos from all 5 days.
That's awesome.
Until, and then here you see huge changes.
Right.
So but all those perturbation experiments happen on minutes or hours. But we're sure, like for example, because oocytes in a steady state, like if you perturb them, change the oxygen, they will go to a new steady state and stay there for a long time. And actually, there's no developmental cure for them. Change their activity of mitochondria.
That is
change
an amazing result.
So that's kind of robust. Like here, right? It's like you don't have to do perturbation. That
that's amazing.
No, it's just like, you know, I think generally like there's something really interesting about oocytes, right? Like so, what we, in terms of, you know, mitochondrial capacity, is what is known from Drosophila. Like when you make an oocyte, you start to deactivate your mitochondria in the sense that you start to degrade a lot of oxidative phosphorylation complexes. So now, you know, when you, at one point it's unclear, like in Drosophila, also in mammalian development, is there kind of like a mitochondrial reactivation in the beginning? So I was like thinking about comparing even my heat measurements of an early embryo to like a similar volume metabolic rate of a bunch of cells later on, and it's much, much lower. So maybe there is some sort of mitochondrial reactivation happening during the early development, which increases your capacity to maybe then respond to demand and supply.
I was wondering, would it, so if I understand correctly, when you use FCCP, then the model doesn't really predict properly?
No, it does. It still predicts that, yeah. Yeah, actually, I didn't show that comparison, but the model does the same thing.
Yeah. So, just a question. You have a set of reactions, and what I saw in the asymptotic limit is rate-limiting step that you see in multi-step chemical reactions. Now, a question is, there could be concentration gradients within the system, spatially dependent. And it will not be that difficult to add on to your model, just a diffusion type term or a transport.
So I don't think that those, so certainly inside mitochondria and outside mitochondria, there's, you know, super important gradients. I don't think inside gradients, either in the cytoplasm or the mitochondria, I think these are just too small and diffusion is too rapid to sustain any reasonable.
Into it.
Yeah, I think I don't think there's any substantial. I mean the gradients inside mitochondria of like diffusing stuff, I think is minuscule.
Yeah, because you do have the proton concentration gradient, right?
But if I say like inside and outside, that's a huge gradient, and that's in here.
And the time for that transport is small compared to the rate steps.
So here, so we don't have a model of like the full thing yet, but like in that kind of diagram which I was showing, that would correspond to this process or that process.
Yeah.
Moving. Yeah. And so definitely, like when we, you know, when Jingbo has the grand unified theory of everything, then hopefully we'll know about those. But that's still in the future.
Yeah. I'm not sure I'm understanding this correctly, but in a lot of these cost estimates that a few of us are making, I think they might assume that the flux rate is constant. And then when, because that's what you're saying is happening.
No,
then,
so
when you add something to build the cell to this new point, you would have the same flux rate, but it takes longer to.
Sorry. My comment wasn't about the calculations which like you and Robert have been doing. My statement was more about if I want to experimentally test those. For me, the most naive thing I would do is I would say, you say that like the spindle costs this amount of energy. I'm going to go in, depolymerize the spindle, see how OCR changed. And I'm just and people have done that in other systems. That won't work in this system is the point. And so if I want to experimentally test that, and that means that in my mind, it becomes less obvious, because I would say that would be the obvious way to test the cost of something. But that clearly doesn't work in this context. And so then I think if one wants to try to experimentally measure the cost, it seems to me that, I mean, one can try some ad hoc thing, but like ultimately I think you need some like model of what's happening. And then you need to say, because ATP levels change by this amount and membrane potential change by that amount, therefore the cost must have been this, or something like that when I perturb it.
I think the way I was thinking, you add something, you're going to build something new in the cell, and it would be irrelevant, it's not doing anything. But you have the same flux rate, right? So I think the prediction would be to build this new thing. And let's say if everything scales with the cell division time, then the additional cell division time would be the flux rate times the time. That would be the cost.
Oh, okay, so that could be an alternative way of doing it, definitely. Maybe a better way to say what I was saying is that people have tried to do what I was just saying. So people have tried to estimate stuff. But in other contexts, it is true that if you have certain stuff, if you have neurons and then you make them and you excite them, then they use more oxygen, right? So that's a true statement. And therefore, people have said, the cost of excitation is blah because it uses this much more oxygen. I was just more commenting on that approach, but maybe that's not
in your process. I think the process is actually sort of good news. It's got the envelope calculations, right?
Yeah, no, it could be. But I would say, I guess I'm making a different statement. I just want to elaborate on that. I'm not saying, is the estimate good or not? That's a separate question. I'm saying, how does one experimentally test that? and I'm commenting on the difficulty of that, is all I'm saying.
Yeah. Adding to that, I think it's more like, Mike's question, it's more like, let's say, if you want to probe the maintenance cost.
Yeah. Right?
So rather than this kind of a growth cost.
Yes,
so,
yes.
Yeah.
So I'm a bit, I'm a bit confused about the demand. So the demand is not on the flux itself, but on something else. What is the demand? What do you mean by demand?
And so I mean there are processes in the so the spindle presumably takes some amount of ATP. So it's when you have a spindle. So in these oocytes, they have a spindle sitting there. They're arrested with the spindle sitting there.
Right.
So presumably it's taking it's that's sitting there. It's hydrolyzing ATP. Right.
So in terms of your model, maybe that's what. So you're saying. You have a bigger or a smaller R, O, X, whatever.
Well, so I guess like if I were to think about this more large model,
right.
There's some rate which ATP is converted to ADP.
Right.
Naively, okay. I would say if I don't have the spindle end anymore, then there are less processes converting ATP to ADP. I would say that this rate has now become smaller.
But it's really not a rate. It's not a times, it's not a unit of a 1 over time, it's actually
flux.
It's flux itself, isn't it?
It is flux. So
therefore, if demand flux cannot be changed by demand, what is the demand?
So, okay, maybe if I understand your question correctly. Okay, so technically, ATP goes to ATP, that's called ATP hydrolysis. Okay, not all ATP hydrolysis, we count as demand.
Yeah, that's not what
because, for example, there's some ATP buffering mechanism in your cell that is not related to how much energy the cell needs. There could be a something that just dumps excessive ATP. But that's going into the details of the mechanism, which is not we're not touching here. But
so in your model seems to show the same thing. So in your model specifically, what is the demand?
No.
What are you changing?
If I interpret the discussion correctly, it is the rate because you're providing more places where ATP can get converted.
No. I also want to clarify. We do not have a model of this whole thing right now.
No. But
this is a conceptual model.
In your model of the
Right. So there evidently we're not changing any. Oh no. Right. Okay. So here's a statement. Right. No. So we are changing things in the sense that so you depolymerize the spindle. This rate of that NADH that's bound to oxidase has now gone down by a factor of 2. But the concentration of NADH bound to oxidase increases by a factor of 2. So the total flux through the system stays the same.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, okay. So
this is experimentally.
Experimentally, but in your didn't you say that your model also reproduces phenomena?
No. And so, what the model gives you, again, because what the model gives this isn't the. What the model gives you is how you relate FLIM measurements to fluxes.
Okay.
It doesn't tell you, I've mechanistically changed this and here's
okay.
The.
So,
so the goal is to get a model of that nature. We're not there yet.
You don't have the model explain why this thing
is. No. That's
okay.
Right.
I think the thing that's amazing about that is that you stock the spindle there.
Yes.
In some ways, we know the spindle costs energy, but there's no cellular metabolic rate response.
You did not
change their metabolic rate.
You changed rates, you haven't changed fluxes.
You didn't change your oxygen consumption. And
yes.
So I think that's in organism
yes.
biology all the time, we ask, is something costly? Like, is immune function costly? Well, so we get something an infection and we ask, does the organismal metabolic rate go up? And
yes.
From that, we would assume there's a cost.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
What this is saying is that there are. Just in the overall structure of the metabolic pathway, even if something is costly,
yep. Exactly.
Internally there's it's basically almost like a plasticity.
Yeah, like some type of buffering or
yeah,
something like
yeah.
that. Exactly. Exactly.
I was gonna say, don't we have to be careful though? Because if this sort of saturated rate can change over longer time scales. Then, if you're like talking about constructing something, you might imagine that the electron transport chain would adapt
its, you know, internal configuration in order to increase the total amount of flux.
No, yeah, right. But I think the point which I was making, the point which she's making, is really more of like an experimental statement about like how do you interpret your measurements. Because, like, you know, like you normally, like the typical thing would be to kind of interpret changes in oxygen consumption rate having to do with changes in demand and stuff like that. And that's clearly not generally true.
I see.
Yeah.
But over a longer time scales, it could be true.
Yeah, in some sense you could say this is an observation, and maybe this is only true in oocytes, you know, like, right? You know what I mean? Like, yeah. But it's just, yeah.
That was one of my questions, is this is an oocyte, right?
Yeah.
Has not divided, or yes. Has not been fertilized to divide.
Yes.
So what are the changes in the dividing embryos?
Yeah, and so, good question.
But you can suddenly change one of the demands.
Yeah.
How long does it take to reach the new state where, you know, two parameter change is not the same?
Minutes. Minutes, or even shorter.
But so there is adaptation time.
But I think that's hard to know whether that's the experimental time scale of like a drug exchange time. In other words,
The input could have its own time scale.
Yeah.
Let's assume the input changing the input or change the demand happened in a shorter time scale.
It's really fast. I mean, maybe seconds even.
Seconds. So you can apply this. You can apply this perturbation in a very short time.
So first, it depends on the nature of the perturbation. For example, pyruvate is usually seconds, fast. There's actually some time associated with disassembling, with spindle, which we know. So for example, for that kind of things, like that might be some actual time scale associated with that, which is minutes.
Uh-huh. But your measurement can almost instantaneous measurement, right?
Yeah.
Your time resolution is very, very good.
Yeah, seconds.
So you can actually track how does it go from R OX1 to ROX2.
Yeah, that's super interesting.
What's the time trajectory?
This seems like why Jonathan should measure oxygen consumption at the same time as he does his
power.
Because that's, you know, how, and also Mike asked the other day, like, what is metabolic rate? When we measure this, like, as oxygen consumption, it'd be very interesting to see whether the, you know, you see these oscillations and you think they're because of a certain biological phenomenon that happens with the cell cycle. It'd be very interesting to see whether the oxygen consumption is basically robust to that.
Yes.
When we know, I mean, clearly things are happening there that are changing the in real time that the ATP available. But maybe the actual oxygen consumption through this chain is really robust to that.
One more year.
Yeah, somebody needs to hire Jonathan so he can buy this really expensive piece of equipment so we can stick the oxygen.
And I just want to advertise one more thing before finishing, because I think it's cool, is that we're also trying to see if we can use this clinically. And so we have a Flynn microscope in an IVF clinic. And this is a human blastocyst, so we're doing the same thing in human eggs, embryos, and associated cells, and trying to see if that could be helpful clinically.